From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. On today's program, nutritionist and fitness expert Robert Ferguson shares important tips on healthy living in communities of color. And Grammy-winning vocalist Cassandra Wilson celebrates what would have been Billie Holiday's 100th birthday with a new project. But first, the Black Arts Movement was one of the most significant cultural movements in American history. The aesthetic counterpart of the Black Power Movement of the 1960s and 70s had contributions from such influential writers as Amira Baraka, Nikki Giovanni, and many others. Those important works have been compiled in a comprehensive volume titled SOS, Calling All Black People a Black Arts Movement Reader. Joining me now to shed light on the incredible work that arose from the Black Arts Movement are the co-editors of the anthology, Professors John H. Bracey, Jr. and James Smethurst, who teach in the Afro-American Studies Department at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, and the incomparable, the inimitable Sonia Sanchez, award-winning poet and professor emerita at Temple University. I'm honored to have all three of you on this program.
Thank you, my dear brother.
Professor Bracey, let me start with you. How would you define, for those who have perhaps heard the term, but don't really know what we are talking about when we say the Black Arts Movement? How would you define that?
What we're talking about is that group of artists and entertainers and political figures, creative people, who put into practice or brought into existence the values and the new kind of shift we made with the Black Power Movement. Two things that were key that happened. You have to remember that Malcolm X died in 1965. Mm-hmm. John Coltrane died in 1967. Mm-hmm. So we're black, but no definition of what black means. Mm. And so we needed artists to come tell us what black meant. And so the poets, the dramatists, you know, the playwrights, the essayists brought out, you know, and the visual artist, Nelson Stevens, mm-hmm. on the cover, helped us work our way through what it meant to be black. We knew we weren't Negroes, but we didn't know what black meant. So mm-hmm. the Black Arts Movement took on that task that Malcolm or Coltrane would have helped us do if they had lived. Mm-hmm. And so they stood in for that, you know, and said, okay, this is what black is all about. So if you read the art and look into the art, listen to the art, you see there's a lot of things about how do you act, how do you behave, what does it mean, how do you relate to men and women, how do you treat yourself, what is Africa to us, who do we come from, now, where are we going? And the Black Arts Movement was the major movement that helped us define as a group of people, black people, who we were when we weren't Negroes anymore.
Professor Smethurst, we are, as I said, talking about the 60s and in the early 70s. How does the time lend itself to the creation of this unique kind of art?
Oh, I think that there's this remarkable confluence of things. Is, of course, you had the civil rights movement in the South and also much of the North. Mm-hmm. They had their own version in Northern and Western cities. I mean, the thing that was amazing about the civil rights movement is it wasn't simply, and as much as I admire Dr. King, it wasn't simply a number of great leaders, but one thing that was so inspiring to the black arts people was this, like, for example, in the black student movement that becomes SNCC, is you have tens of thousands of young black people, ultimately hundreds of thousands of people who rise up, and they're not waiting around from orders from Dr. King or from Moscow or any other kind of outside mm-hmm. agitators, as they said, to stand up and act and to try to take control of their own destiny. I think that was very influential in terms of black artists partly wanting to be a part of this, but also saying, you know, we don't have to wait around. They had a lot of respect for their elders, but we can do it. The other thing that was, it was, you know, liberation going on around the world. It's, you know, Africa was the continent of hope in those days. Mm-hmm. Nkrumah, Ben Bella, North and South, Sekou Touré, Kenyatta, Niger. I mean, it was an amazing, that's just a few, just mm-hmm. Mandela, just an amazing place where all these new ideas, these movements are coming forward. Cuba, India, China, the peoples, as we might say, of color rising up. And I think that people felt themselves a part of it. So it was a great spirit of optimism, a great spirit of we can do things, we can change things in a way that it hadn't been quite before.
What struck me about the book when I first saw it was that it is one thing for the two of you to be working on a text like this about the Black Arts Movement. It's quite another thing to have someone who was in the Black Arts Movement, one of the curators of that movement, to be a part of this project with you. So how did Sonia Sanchez get to be a part of this?
You know, the book grew out of arguments that we've been having, discussions we've been having for about, you know, over a decade now. Uh-huh. I met Sonia 40 years ago when she was the chair of Black Studies at Amherst College. And the side of Sonia people don't give enough credit to is her political work. Mm-hmm. She's a great poet, no doubt about that. But she also is a great political figure. And so we fought together to get Black Studies at Amherst College, and we've been political allies ever since. She drags me into the art world, and I, you know, keep her. I even did a poem, a haiku. I got a haiku on the wall in Philly because of Sonia. But it's political work, and we were discussing how come nobody could see the connection? Because the way people talk about Black arts, they say there were cultural nationalists over here, political people over here, and that wasn't what we felt. That wasn't what we lived. You know, I was in the Revolutionary Action Movement. Well, we had artists in that movement. You know, Oscar Touré, Larry Neal, and so forth, right? And Sonia was a political figure. It doesn't make any sense to talk about Sonia as if she only does art and not politics. You know, her art by definition is political. And so what we wanted was to put back together the world that we lived in. Mm-hmm. You know, and so we talked about it for a long time. You know, we'd meet in Philadelphia working on other projects. Jim did a book on the Black Arts Movement, you know, the first, you know, kind of historic study of the Black Arts Movement. So we said, look, why don't we do it? And the way we set it up, I was a historian, but I lived through the movement. I'm one of the audience that sat there and heard Baraka when he said SOS calling all black people. Mm-hmm. Sonia was the leading figure we were listening to. She was on the stage. Jim comes along after us, a little bit younger, you know, a whole lot younger, not so much younger. Right?
And thank so, you. Thank
and so he's the student of it. So we figured we have these three different perspectives
right.
to make sure we could pick everything. I picked stuff that I liked and what I heard. Like if you had a great poem, if I didn't hear it, it didn't mean a thing to me.
Right.
If you had a great play, if I never saw it, it didn't mean a thing to me. Jim comes late and says he picks the things we overlooked because we weren't paying attention to them. So what this reader does, of course, is try to pull all that together. Sonia, of course, was there. She's at the heart of it. She's at the middle of it.
Exactly.
Right? She can call the people in that we could never talk to. This book has people in it that don't even talk to each other. But they talk to Sonia.
They talk to Sonia,
They talk to Sonia.
And if, can I just piggyback on one thing? The other thing, just really quick, is also something that people don't always recognize about Sonia, besides her great work as an artist and a political figure, is she, as John says, is one of the founders of Black Studies. She is like one of the very first people in the United States to teach courses in African American literature. So she is, you know, one of the founders of our field, one of the founders of our scholars. Yeah. So for her to do a scholar, in a sense, I mean, it's a scholarly text that was intended also for people in the community, but it really... It's no contradiction. Yeah.
Sister Sonia, now that we've thoroughly embarrassed you.
You have.
I know you. You're such an humble spirit. Now that we have thoroughly embarrassed you, while you are still 80 years young, since I last saw you, you turned 80,
right.
in fact.
That's right.
So you're still 80 years young. But situate this piece of work for me, this anthology, this pulling together of the best of the Black Arts Movement artistically. How does this situate itself in the rest of your work, particularly at this point in your life?
Well, my dear brother, I thought it was so important to, at this time, because of what is going on in America now, to show young people that what they are experiencing now, we experienced also, too, that the racism has not changed at all. But the reaction to it, you know, was a reaction to it. And what we did culturally and politically and through via organizations, although we didn't even agree with all of the organizations, what's so vital about this book, my dear brother, is that we present everyone and we don't take sides. We don't say, well, you should follow this one or that one, whatever. We gave you every organization, you know, every poet that we did not agree with also, too. It's there, every playwright, you know, every person writing the stories. And what we did, we said simply, you've got to see that in the midst of great distress in the 1960s, you know, we responded. We've done book signings all over, and this young sister, you know, came up, and she said, can I speak to you for a minute? And there was this long line, so I said, well, I guess so. She said, I want you to know that I've been educated in private schools all my life, so therefore I couldn't understand Ferguson, because no white person's ever said anything negative to me. She said, I hope you won't laugh at me. And I stood up and hugged her. I said, my dear sister, you're not by yourself. That has happened, you know, since the 1960s and 70s. She said, this book, and the book was tattered, right? She mm-hmm. said, this book has given me insight as to what I must do as this black person, what I must be about at this as this black person, as this black person. And then she said, and the other thing she said is that I've seen you for years. I didn't know you cursed. And in that book, you know,
yeah.
I said, but that was done on purpose. Mm-hmm. I knew that some people might not want that history shown right. after so many years. Yeah. But I wanted people to see that we were world warriors at the time. And this country had never been called MFs or anything like that. But we did it out loud because Malcolm gave us, you know, the leeway to say, you must begin to talk out loud and say things about, you know, what is going on in this America. He gave us the leeway. So I said, I'm 80. You know, I'm old enough to say, yeah, I said that, you know, back then in the 60s. I don't say it now. And we didn't say it, we didn't continue to say it, but at some point we had to call. You know how when you're playing in the streets yeah. as young, we had to call the man. Like mm-hmm. we said, this is what you did, man, yeah. mm-hmm. and we did it. But we didn't keep hitting him on the head. We did the work afterwards.
Would you mind grabbing your reader?
Uh huh.
Malcolm's name's been mentioned here a couple times already in this conversation. We've heard
right.
the name Malcolm X come up, and there's a beautiful piece called Malcolm.
Right.
That I wonder if you will read for me.
I'd love to read it.
Your piece on page 317
right.
of the Reader.
Simply called Malcolm. Do not speak to me of martyrdom, of men who die to be remembered on some parish day. I don't believe in dying, though I too shall die, and violets like castanets will echo me. Yet this man, this dreamer, thick-lipped with words, will never speak again. And in each winter when the cold air cracks with frost, I'll breathe his breath and mourn my gun-filled nights. He was the sun that tagged the western sky and melted tiger scholars while they searched for stripes. He said, forget you, white man. We have been curled too long. Nothing is sacred now, not your white face, nor any land that separates until some voices squat with spasms. Do not speak to me of living. Life is obscene with crowds of white on black. Death is my pulse. What might have been is not for him or me, but what could have been floods the womb until I drown.
Mm-hmm. It's powerful.
Right.
What's your sense? You didn't just live through it, as both professors have already articulated. You were a part of it. You were on the stage. What is your sense of what the black arts movement has meant to the fabric of this country?
It changed everything. We've discussed this on yeah. many occasions, yeah. you know. It changed yeah. how people got money for being artistic, you know. Before, you didn't have all these organizations that gave money for you as an artist. It changed that. It changed the way people perceived us. You would not have a program on this channel without the whole move
Amen.
Of the black arts and yeah. and say a woman to that too.
A woman.
Right, yeah,
Amen.
You know,
a woman.
You know,
yeah.
you know, but you wouldn't
any PBS before this.
That's
yeah.
right.
Yeah,
you know,
I mean,
so PBS comes out of yeah. that whole idea yeah. of, you know, this public art. But also,
yeah.
what we did too, we said, you know, you can write a political poem and it can be great. You know, it doesn't have to be, you know, mm-hmm. but it could be a great poem. We could write this great poetry yeah. like other people have done in other countries, you yeah. see, and it can be political, you know, it can be loving, you know, it can be about self-determination, but it is we writing mm-hmm. it saying simply, look at this, look what mm-hmm. we are doing. And we simply said to America, you know, we're here, and we're here to take you on. Mm-hmm. We are here to say to you, you're racist, you know, but let's sit down and have a talk about this. Let's mm-hmm. have a discussion about this.
Let me just go back right quick to something you said a moment ago and Professor Bracey mm-hmm. commented on, and this is something that I'm awfully passionate about because I live this every day. I've been on public radio now for 15 years.
That's right.
I've been on PBS now. This is our 12th season.
That's right.
And it is important for the audience to know exactly what you said. It is during the Johnson administration
mm-hmm.
where the black arts movement has taken off
right. mm-hmm.
that Johnson has the good sense to understand
that's right.
that there have to be mediums that specifically allow two audiences who have been underserved
mm-hmm.
to be served.
Exactly.
One, African Americans,
right.
Negro, colored people.
Right.
Right.
Secondly, children. The reason
right.
why PBS has a strong children's programming block
yeah.
every day
mm-hmm.
is because that was one of the original intents of PBS,
yeah.
to service children
exactly.
and to service people of color.
Yeah.
Now, I fight this fight all the time because all these years later, I don't need to finish this speech.
Right.
All these years later, in the most multicultural, multiracial, multi-ethnic America ever, there are still too many fellow citizens who think that public television and public radio are wholly owned subsidiaries of white America, and that is not the case.
That's
so I'm not saying that to bash anybody, but it's important that those who watch PBS and those who listen to public radio understand how these two mediums came to be in the first place, Professor Bracey.
We found a mass audience. You know, poetry used to be you went to a coffee shop and you read to five people. You know, I followed Barack when he was a beat, when he was Leroy Jones, when I was on the campus at Howard University. It was 20 people in the room. That's different from Barack then coming 5 years later to Dunbar High School Auditorium with 2,000 people
That's
in the
right.
room.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what he did and what the Black Arts Movement did was there are people out there who art is accessible to if you bring it to them. Not if you make them come to it in a museum or in an auditorium somewhere you have to pay $20, but where you can make it cheap for them. You know, you stand out, you put the play on the side of a building, right? You know, you get two spotlights and you get a couple of kids say you want to be in a play. Here, read this, right? And you found a tremendous audience of young people who were thirsting for art. You know, you have Nelson Stevens and the mural movement. He said you can take a building in your neighborhood that's an old, dirty building, and we can make it a beautiful building. By putting the colors of our people all across that building, the Wall of Respect in Chicago, you know, all the murals that Nelson did in Springfield.
And let me say, there is no city like Philadelphia leads
Philadelphia
the nation,
has,
your hometown.
That's right.
Yeah. These murals, I've seen, one of them focuses on you, as a matter of fact.
And then now we have one on peace,
Talk about how the arts movement has impacted the city of Philadelphia and why there's so many murals, beautiful murals, all over the city of Philadelphia.
There was a young brother, he died, who had the idea, perhaps, that maybe we should have, the paintings on the walls at that time in areas like, you know, North Philadelphia, West Philadelphia, also Germantown, et cetera. And he did this, and he died. And then it was picked up by a sister who runs Mural Arts now in Philadelphia. She does an amazing job there. And one of the things that you see all over the city of Philadelphia, you'll see a mural of Malcolm. You'll see a mural of MLK. You know, all of these great people there. And when they made me the poet laureate of the city, they asked, what do you want to do? And the first thing I said, let's do a mural about peace. Peace, whatever. And I called Sister Toni Morrison, Sister Maya Angelou. I called Alice Walker. I called Bernice Reagan. I called Professor Bracey. And then I went to see Carmen at one of his movies. And I said, man, as we walked down, you know how you walk down the red carpet? And those sisters had those heels like that, you know, whatever. And I'm being I dress like I dress as a poet. I said, man, you got to do a peace haiku for me. We have a peace haiku in a place called Philadelphia, you know, which is utterly amazing. But I wanted to say, we not only went into the universities. I mean, Baraka and Aski and I were on Lenox Avenue one day, went into a bar and said, we're going to come back and read some poetry to you. And the guy said, lady, if you want to, I don't know about no poetry in my bar.
Yeah.
We came at 8 o'clock, pulled the plug on the jukebox. Ain't that being brave?
Yeah.
People turned around and said, what is this?
Yeah.
And what did we say? We were wise enough to know that I started cursing in a poem. And I got their attention. They said, you hear that? You hear what she just said? But later on, we didn't say another curse word. But we gathered them together.
Yeah.
I'm walking down the street 2 days later from my father's house, and the brother said, yo, you, ain't you that poet? I said, yes. He said, when you coming back? I went home and told my old lady. She got mad at me. That was good.
Yeah.
That's what we did. We took the poetry to the people, you know, and the people came, my dear brother.
Professor Matt Hurst, I hate to put you on the spot as the token white male on this show.
Okay.
No, that's all right.
I know you can handle it. What is the value of the Black arts movement to America writ large?
Well, I mean, it changed all of us. I mean, for one thing, you know, it puts, and this, you know, is something that white people and other people in the United States, besides African Americans, have to think about, and I think it's a great thing, actually, is that it put Black art, visual art, literature, theater, dance, right at the center of U.S.
Center.
Culture in the same way that Black music had already been there.
Mm-hmm.
So that, created this great body and influenced these writers who come after, and you know, you can call yourself post-Black or post-soul or whatever, but really what those people are doing are call themselves post-Black arts. So you're still thinking about the Black arts movement. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you look at the bestseller list right now. What's on it? Toni Morrison's new mm-hmm. novel. Mm-hmm. You know, this is something that I think is had an impact on all of us. But as Sonia was saying and John was saying, it also changed how everybody in the U.S. looks at art, how we understand art. Once again, as a poet and arts critic and arts administrator, A.B. Spellman, said to me, we created, that is the black arts movement, the public sector. Mm-hmm. And that NEA, NEH, PBS, NPR really come into the space that was blown wide open by black arts. Mm-hmm. Now, as you know better than anybody, there's great debates about what should be on PBS, mm-hmm. what should be on NPR, what NEH and NEA should support and all the other governmental things. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't seem strange to people in the United States, you know, everybody, including me, that such support should exist. Right. Whereas before, you know, in 1961, you know, basically, or in the early Johnson administration, public art meant Lady Bird Johnson's highway beautification program. Mm-hmm. There really hadn't been public art since that. The other piece, though, I was going to say is that art can be popular and serious at the same time in a way it hadn't been before. And this changed all. That someone like Kanye West could record something like New Slaves or Lil Wayne, who these are people we don't think of precisely as conscious artists,
right.
Could God Bless America. That's like the most radical, you watch the video, and mm-hmm. is the most radical thing I can imagine, critique of the United States. And millions of people are doing it, you know, and white people as well as other people in the United States. And so I have to say the movement changed me, even though I didn't know it.
Professor Bracey, right quick, to your mind, what is the risk that these artists took in speaking these uncomfortable, inconvenient, unhousing truths?
The risk you took is that if you want to be free, you have to stand up and be prepared to risk. If somebody gives you your freedom, then they can take it away. If you take your freedom, it's yours forever. So when Baraka stood up, when Gwendolyn Brooks threw away $1 million contract to come to Broadside Press, you have to stand with her. Mm. You know, if you risk your life going out in the street in a demonstration and an artist risks their career by rejecting a grant, by rejecting Baraka, rejecting patronage and going up to Harlem and leaving the village, then what you're saying is that this is our fight. This is everybody's fight. Nobody's exempt from this fight. And it was a call to action. You know, Malcolm had made us black people, but he wasn't there to tell us how to be black. So we got to do that. If we want to hold on to that legacy, Malcolm's legacy, Coltrane's legacy, that's on us. We took up that mantle, and we judged ourselves by that. If you didn't stand up for that, you know, like I have to tell everybody, if you didn't like Coltrane, I didn't want to talk to you.
Yeah.
I didn't want to talk to you. Like, whatever else you may like, if you
right.
like Coltrane.
If you like Coltrane, yeah.
I mean, that was my bottom line. You have to like all of Coltrane, but if you say you like any Coltrane, that's the end of it.
Well, I like Coltrane and Sonia Sanchez, so I'll give her the last word. What, for you, Sister Sonia, is the abiding lesson, the takeaway from the Black Arts Movement?
That you can resist. Mm. That you must resist. Yeah. That you must wake up every morning the way I do and say, eBay, yee, yee, it's going to get better. eBay, yee, 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 it's going to get better. eBay, yee, 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 because I resist it, because I resist it. I'm going to always resist. I'm going to always resist. Hey, 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 hey. We got to resist, my dear brother. You must always resist because we need you. Mm-hmm. Okay?
Sonia Sanchez has so many honors, but she is about to be inducted into the Alabama Writers Hall of Fame. And so let me congratulate you in advance on that high honor coming in the month of June. Mm-hmm. And congratulations to both Professors Bracey and Smethurst on a wonderful book. It must feel awfully nice to do something that's going to be around for generations to come.
Oh, my dear brother.
That chronicles the period in this country.
It's a labor of love. It was a long time coming, but we are so happy.
I am so glad you have it. It's called SOS, Calling All Black People, a Black Arts Movement Reader. It's finally out. You should get it, add it to your collection. Yeah. If you ever need a resource guide for anything in that era of this country's grand history, this is the text for you. Congratulations to all three. Good to have you on this program.
Thank you, my dear brother.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Healthy living can be a difficult challenge in communities of color. Access to fresh and nutritious food is often lacking, and better education on making healthy choices is sorely needed. But Robert Ferguson, a certified nutritionist and CEO of the health outreach company Diet Free Life, says those obstacles are not insurmountable. Ferguson, who serves on the Presidential Task Force on Obesity for the National Medical Association, joins us now. Robert, thank you for your work, and good to have you on this program.
It's great to be here.
Let me start with the obvious question, which I don't ask out of any naivete, but why is this issue so much more acute and so much more difficult to tackle in communities of color?
The first thing that comes to mind is that the people who are making the decisions as far as how we're going to help those people who are in need, there's a disconnect, and the disconnect is cultural. So the foods that they're bringing to the table aren't foods that people identify with. And so they're speaking to them in a way where people can't embrace it. Mm-hmm. And as a result of not being able to embrace it, everyone goes back to their normal jobs and go back and do what they're going to do. And the people who we want to help don't get helped.
For those persons who don't understand what those language and food barriers are, give me an example.
Okay. For instance, we have, as you know, quite a few people who are going to food banks, and they're getting that type of assistance. So if you're getting boxed cheese and top ramen and canned beans, how do you make that work when the people telling you how to become healthier, that dialogue is all about wild salmon, asparagus. And so the recommendations they're giving aren't recommendations that meet people where they are. And so a big part of our work is showing people how to make the most of their situations. So whether it's working and building what we call fat-burning meals with those types of foods, or showing people how to make the most of going to a fast food restaurant. Instead of demonizing the restaurants, we show people how to make it work no matter what their situation.
Ought they, I'm not calling names here, you're working with what you have. You're playing the hand you've been dealt. If you live in a community where you only have fast food choices, and I hear your point, you want to help people make the best choices that they can with these fast food outlets without demonizing the fast food outlet. But should these fast food outlets be demonized?
No, because there's a lot of laws in place so that when the foods do come to the table, as far as whether it's the Golden Arches or any of these fast food restaurants, they're not just making up things or just putting information out there or food, making food available to people that isn't fit for consumption. So giving them a little bit more credit for what it's worth, the goal is to show people how to make the most of those foods. And unfortunately, the big companies, the big fast food restaurants, they're having a tough time bringing clarity to the fact that we're not giving people food that we believe is going to kill them. We're giving people food that, you know, as part of our business, and it's food that we believe that they can consume and not hinder their health. See, to me, it's all about how much food are you eating of certain foods that cause the problems. You know, if I ate a Big Mac by itself, that's a fat-burning meal. But if I ate the Big Mac with the fries and the large soda and the cookies on the side, then I'm setting myself up for some problems.
So long as people, though, don't have the best choices in certain communities, they're always going to be like behind the eight ball, it seems to me.
Well, yes and no.
Okay.
Because if you went into like some of these restaurants, like McDonald's, for instance, they have Newman's Own salad dressing, organic. They have salads. They sell a ton of apples. So it's really just showing people how to make the most of those situations when they go to a fast food restaurant.
But if they're not going to fast food restaurants and they're going to supermarkets, I mean, this story is an old story, that they don't have access to fresh fruit, to fresh meat, to fresh vegetables. You got to drive miles away to get that. Now you got a transportation issue. So, you know, outside of the lane of doing the best you can with the fast food you have available to you, how do you survive?
Well, I mean, in this country that we live in, abundance is everywhere.
Right.
So we definitely aren't having a hard time getting access to food.
Right.
Now, there are places in this country, because I've traveled to them, where they have major challenges with access.
Food deserts, they call them.
Major.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, you know, you can do the best you can with helping those people, but now you're bringing in transportation. You're looking at how much money these people have. You're looking at their educational level. It makes it real challenging to be able to help these people. But for the most part, when I've gone to those areas that are food deserts, you can still get a banana, you can still get an apple, and you still have access to a lot of foods that people would categorize as healthy.
How much of this, though, is about food versus exercise and other healthy lifestyles?
I believe it's all important. You know, I believe in the three-legged stool, mindset. So I believe that the way we think, what we think about is a big part of it. I believe that nutrition is king, in the words of Jacqueline Lane. And I believe that exercise is queen. And I believe that becoming more active, getting people to move more is helpful. But at the same time, we have this big disconnect, right? We have people saying to exercise a certain way, and that's a turnoff for a lot of people. You know, walking is the number one form of exercise, like, done or preferred in America. However, from a psychosocial standpoint, you can't always walk in certain neighborhoods at 5 p.m., mm-hmm. right? So, you know, meeting people where they are is showing them how to make it work based on their situations, and there's so many dynamics that makes it very difficult to do.
So if you can't walk at 5 p.m., to your point, then what do you do?
Well, then you work out inside.
Yeah.
You look at, there's community outreaches that are taking place where they have buses that go into neighborhoods. A lot of churches are doing things like this, and then they'll transport people out, give them an opportunity to learn about, like, healthier eating, mm-hmm. to learn how to exercise, and to have access to ways to exercise.
You know, the part that's always difficult for me to swallow, no pun intended, is that losing weight, maintaining weight, is not easy to do in the first place. I mean, it takes dedication. Let's be honest about it. It takes dedication. God knows I know. It takes dedication. It takes discipline. It takes all of the above. And when you happen to live in certain communities and you have to work, as you just laid out, you've got great ideas. But when you have to work that much harder to do something that's already hard to do anyway, I mean, realistically, it becomes difficult for people to wrap their brains around that they got to work that much harder to do something that ain't easy in the first place.
Oh, it's tough.
Yeah.
It is tough. And it's like it's almost like, you know, asking someone to go to Vietnam War and they don't get to go to boot camp.
Yeah.
It's like we're throwing them into a situation where they can't win.
Right.
But they can. And I've seen it. And a lot of it goes back to mindset and having someone that they can anchor toward that can move them. And the flip side of that is that I think a lot of what we're doing is hurting the process. What I mean by that is when you have people, leaders, that get out in front and they talk about being more active and eating healthier, and they start to demonize certain foods, then people at home, I mean, that can really hurt them and cause them to spiral downward and to think that they could never be successful because they can't do what the leaders are doing. You know, they can't have access to the same things that, say, a celebrity has access to, like a personal trainer mm-hmm. or a gym, mm-hmm. and to be able to do the things that they're doing. And that can play a major role on hindering someone's mindset.
Where do you see us making progress on this issue? And I raise that only because whenever we have these conversations as part of our Road to Health segment on this program, whenever we have these conversations, particularly about obesity and about diet and all of that, the evidence is so damning that not a lot of progress is being made. And obviously, if there weren't hope, then you and others wouldn't be doing what you're doing. But like, where do you see progress being made, though?
Well, you know what? Progress is made with getting the families involved. Mm-hmm. Like, there's a big project I'm doing in the state of Missouri. And then in Missouri, we're going to reverse childhood obesity. And we're going to do it because we're going to the parents. We're not skirting around or going to the cafeterias. Mm-hmm. We're going to get the parents to adopt a healthier lifestyle and way of thinking. And as a result, their kids are going to become healthier. And the reason for that is that we know statistically that if one parent, okay, or guardian is overweight mm-hmm. or obese, the kid is 40% more likely to be overweight or obese as an adult. But if both parents are overweight, we're looking at 80%.
So how do you get parental buy-in?
Give them the sizzle.
Yeah.
You got to make it fun, right?
Yeah.
Everybody wants to look great for the summer. You got to take that approach, get them in the tent. And once we get them in the tent and they embrace it and it's easy, there's no, you know, they're not being demonized, nothing's being demonized. They're being shown how to make the most of their situations. Then we have a win-win.
You might have just answered this, but how and why in this country do you think childhood obesity specifically got so out of control?
That's the big question, and I believe it has a lot to do with the challenges that we have as adults with our weight and our health. I believe it has a lot to do with transportation and lack thereof. I believe that kids are playing the video games more than, mm-hmm. you know, when you and I were a kid. We were out running around. Staying outside as long as possible. So I think it's just, there's so many things. And I think when you look at just one way of reversing the cause, you're probably not going to find it. You'll just chase the effects constantly.
Yeah. Do you think the country sees this as a cultural problem? And if they do, is that a good thing or a bad thing?
I think they see it as a cultural problem.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Is that good or bad?
I think that's a very challenging question.
Yeah.
And it's not real clear. Because I think we're so multicultural that there's so many dynamics that come into play. I believe it has more to do with leadership than anything else. And a big part of that leadership is speaking and defining health in a way that most people can't access that type of health.
So what makes you hopeful about the work that you do?
Because I'm given a chance now to do the work.
Yeah.
You know, working with, you know, companies like Aetna, you know, and giving me access to opportunities to empower these families. Once we get, you know, some momentum there and we demonstrate that with some clinical studies, then it's just a matter of scaling it out, you know, nationwide. So, I really believe that it's all about nutrition IQ.
Yeah.
I believe that, like, if you knew what I knew about nutrition, then you could look at certain foods and say, okay, he can go any restaurant he wants, and he can build what I call a fat-burning meal.
Right.
Because I can. So you can put me in a food desert.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter where you put me, and I'm going to make it work because I know a little bit more than the average person. Well, the same things that I know, everybody can know.
So it's about the science.
Yes, it's the science. It's just really being aware, right? It's just having the knowledge and not feeling deprived or restricted. Because when someone feels like they can't have something or the answer is no, then we fight the grain.
Yeah.
We go against it. So we'll be very successful just because the parents are going to embrace it. And then we do what we tend to see our parents do, not so much what they tell us.
Yep. I'm wishing you all the best in it.
It's work, but we're doing it.
You're going to do it. Good to have you on. Robert Ferguson, CEO of Diet Free Life.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Billie Holiday, the iconic singer known as Lady Day, would have turned 100 this year. She inspired another vocalist who has become an icon in her own right, Grammy winner Cassandra Wilson, who's celebrating Holiday's centennial with a new project called Coming Forth by Day, a tribute to Billie Holiday. Before we start our conversation with Cassandra, let's hear a bit from the recording session for the project.
Up in my bed in now. The next time you record something, I would love to just come sit in the corner
You are always welcome.
I would just come sit in the corner and watch you do what you do. You sound so good.
We enjoyed that. We had a great time doing it.
Is there there's obviously a process, but is there some process that you go through every time you're about to go into the studio? Everybody has a ritual. That's what I was looking for.
A ritual.
Some sort of ritual, some sort of... How do you approach going into the studio?
My ritual is not to have a ritual.
Oh, okay. I liked it. That works.
My ritual is not to prepare too much because, you know, if you prepare too much, then you don't allow things to just happen.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the things that I guess, you know, I'm famous for.
Yeah.
I go in unprepared.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a little bit prepared for this because I've been singing Billie Holiday's music, you know, for most of my career.
Yeah.
But I didn't want to do too much so that it could just really happen in the moment.
That makes sense to me. I mean, I get that. I'm lecturing all the time around the country, and I do not speak from notes.
I noticed that about you, too.
Yeah. I prepare. I mean, I go in. I've been asked to talk about whatever the subject is or an evening with Tavis Smiley. I have an idea of what I want to talk about. So in my head, I've got my thoughts together. But
you're off the cuff.
I like that. It's that. I mean, I figure that, and I think you feel the same way, whatever God has for the audience that day, you kind of want it to flow, whatever the spirit, you know, what one believes in, has for the audience that day, you want it to kind of flow through you. And if you're just reading something, and I ain't mad at folk who do, but if you're just reading off the page, the same script everywhere you go, it just doesn't...
It doesn't live.
Yeah, it's not organic.
It's not organic, exactly.
Yeah. So what you've been singing her stuff for years, but what is the the backstory of the Cassandra Billie Holiday relationship connection?
Well, there is a backstory. Mm-hmm. I'm glad you asked. I'm in that lineage of singers. I see myself as in that line. Mm-hmm. Abby Lincoln, as you mm-hmm. know, Abby Lincoln was very close to my mm-hmm. heart, very dear to my heart, and she was my mentor. Mm-hmm. And of course, Abby's, the icon that Abby followed after was Billie Holiday. Mm-hmm. So that's the connection there. That's one of the connections there. She is a musician's singer. Mm-hmm. The musicians all love her, you know, Billie Holiday, mm-hmm. because she has a certain approach to the music and a certain way of getting down in the trenches with the guys. I do that as well.
Mm-hmm. What do you recall was the first thing that you heard her sing? What album, what record did you connect to first? Do you recall?
I do, because my mother recited the refrain from it almost every day to me. God bless the child.
Somebody, I knew you were going to say that.
That's so, got her own.
Yeah.
Them that's got shall get.
God shall get. Them that's not shall lose. So the Bible said, and it still is news. Mama may have, Papa may have, but God bless the child that's got his own. That's got his
own. In other words,
that's got, yeah.
Get out and get a job.
Yeah.
So she told you that repeatedly.
Oh, over and over again. It became, that was her mantra.
Yeah.
And it worked,
yeah.
Eventually.
And when you actually, yeah, when you actually heard the song,
mm-hmm.
what do you recall about connecting to it when you actually heard the lady singing, but your mama had been telling you every day?
I think about my, yeah, think about my mama.
Yeah.
But I think about how strong Billie Holiday was, uh-huh. what a powerful woman
right.
she was. And that's what we're focusing on mm-hmm. is really not the, not so much the dark side,
right.
but the beauty and the power and the majesty uh-huh. of her work.
That is, you chose an interesting word, and I think I get it, but I want to give you a chance to unpack it so that I'm sure that I get what you meant by it. For those who know a bit about the Billie Holiday story, they might be taken aback by your word strong to describe her, and you know where I'm going with this.
Yeah.
One could argue that she was weak, and her weakness was the drug. But when you say the strength of Billie Holiday, what do you mean by that?
Well, I think it takes a lot of strength to sing a song like Strange Fruit mm-hmm. in, what was the year, 1939? You have to be a very powerful personality in order to pull that off, first mm-hmm. of all.
Southern trees bear strange fruit. Blood on the leaves and blood at the root.
Billie Holiday was a paradox. You know, we hear the stories about the drug abuse, but there's a backstory to that as well, I think. There's an interesting article called The Hunting of mm-hmm. Billie Holiday. And it just so happens that all of her troubles with drugs coincide with the emergence of the DEA.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a backstory to that as well. I don't know how much of that is actually
yeah.
true.
Yeah. What do you, how would you describe, in your own words, her gift, her artistry?
I think she had a great gift for reaching inside of the heart.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she was able to relate very powerful human emotions. And this is what makes her a universal figure. I think this is why people are so drawn to her music, is because she had a great gift for detailing very, very nuanced
yeah.
emotions, very nuanced feelings.
Yeah. In terms of the playlist, how did you decide that these would be the tracks that you would record? And tell me something about the tracks that you did record.
Wow. It was a very organic process.
Mm-hmm.
I listened to friends. My manager had great ideas on what songs to do. Working with Nick Lawney, who's the producer for The Bad Seeds, and Nick Cave, he had some really, really great insight into, you know, what would be good material to do. So it just all kind of worked together, and it really came out surprisingly well.
Yeah. I wonder if I could just throw a couple songs that we've already talked about, and I wonder if there is some I don't want to put too much on it, but some kind of feeling or something that you can tell me about what happens when you sing these particular songs. Mm. Like when you sing Strange Fruit, like what happens? What's that like?
Well, I have to tell you, you can't do Strange Fruit every night.
Yeah. That's what I figured. Yeah.
You can't do it every night. Yeah. It's only in certain circumstances. And there's a place that you go in your head. You know, my mother witnessed a lynching.
Yeah.
And whenever I sing that song, I draw upon the memory of her description right. of that event. And it does take a lot out of you.
Mm-hmm. Is there another one that, let me go to the other side. a Lady Day song that you love to sing, that you could sing every night.
Oh, yeah.
Because you love it that much.
These Foolish Things is a really beautiful ballad, mm-hmm. and it's about enduring love. You know, I love that song. I could sing that one every night. And also, Billy's Blues, one of the few songs that mm-hmm. she penned herself.
Mm-hmm. I love my man. I'm a lie if I say I don't. I love my man. I'm a liar if I say I don't. But I'll quit my man. I'm a liar if I say I won't.
It's really powerful. It's a woman's statement.
Yeah. Speaking of pinning for yourself, there is a track on here that you pinned.
Yes.
For Lesta.
Yes.
Yeah. Tell me about the song.
The story is about, when Lester Young mm-hmm. passed away, Billie Holiday was in London.
And Prez.
Yeah, yeah. Prez passed away.
Yeah.
And he had just been on tour, came back suddenly and collapsed, died. She was in London. They had had words. They had had a falling out, I think, for a couple of years. So she flew back immediately because they were very close. They were musical soulmates. And she attended the funeral and fully expected to be able to sing. But for some reason, Lester Young's family would not allow her to sing. So she was devastated by this. And she said, I'll be the next to go. 5 months later, she was gone. Mm. So we wrote this song for her to be able to sing the song for Lester now.
I flew from far away. They said the last notes of your tenor played. You faded fast.
And it's called Last Song. For Lester.
Finally, yeah. Tell me about this story, which I was just stunned when I saw it. About this, I started talking about this connection you have to Billy. Mm-hmm. Tell me about this photo with your auntie, your family, and Billy hanging out.
My titi.
Yeah.
It's a photograph that I found in the album, in a photo album. I'm just going through, you know, I was like 16, 17 years old. Just starting to, you know, really dig into the music. And I see this photograph, and I'm looking at this. I don't know these people. And I said, my daddy. I said, Daddy, who are these people? Mm-hmm. I know that's my aunt. Who are these other people? And he said, well, that's Billie Holiday in the middle. And the other lady on the other side is a friend of your aunt's. Mm-hmm. It just so happened Billie Holiday was, I think she'd done a performance in town, and mm-hmm. she went to a party afterwards. And it was, my aunt was there. So it was like a selfie.
Yeah. old school selfie.
Old school selfie, right.
That's a beautiful familial connection, though.
It is.
And here you are singing this stuff.
It is.
On the occasion of her 100th birthday, what would have been her 100th birthday. And so to honor Billie Holiday with a beautiful tribute, as only she could do. It's called Coming Forth by Day. Miss Wilson, you are one bad sister. And I am so always honored to have you on this program, and thank you for your work.
It's always a pleasure
to see you.
You can catch me weeknights on my television show on PBS. For more info on what I'm doing or to hear this show, past shows, or the Tavis Smiley Show podcast, visit TavisSmileyRadio.com. The Tavis Smiley Show is a news and opinion program produced and recorded in Los Angeles by SRP Productions in partnership with Public Radio International. Tony Marcano is our executive producer. I'm Tavis Smiley. This is PRI. Keep the faith.